There's too many fucking Marys.
Welcome to Antique Tea, because what is history if not gossip that's aged really well? My name's Erica Mighty. I'm a voice actor and a lapsed history major.
My name's Jason, and my love of soccer, the real kind, runs deep, and I just discovered the magic of gel pens.
Oh, you clearly were not a tween in the late 90s.
I was not. You know, when I was a tween, I don't think the word tween actually existed. It hadn't been invented yet.
You know, I think you're right, because I remember hearing the word tween for the first time right after I was a tween and thinking it was like a dumb word.
Oh, so you were like, you almost were a tween. You almost were able to be called that.
Yeah. Sort of took off in the early 2000s, I think.
Yeah, it's true, though. It really does need its own. I have a teen. Mm. I have a teenager now. But that period when you're a tween, it is like it's its own separate thing.
It was brutal. It's like the age when kids have just enough understanding to start feeling a little bit adult. But they still have, like, the animal instincts that they had when they were children of just, like, destroy, attack.
Yeah. And that is literally why middle schools are their own school. You have to, like, segregate them because it's such a horrible time of life that they can't be in elementary school. They can't be in high school. They need their own school.
Have you noticed that middle schools smell uniquely awful as well? Like, the second you walk into a middle school, it's just this, like, 13-year-old boy funk.
Yeah. Yep. Smell. I mean, that's my son's bedroom. Smells like that. So now, currently.
Oh, no. Well, last episode was the first in our Young Romantics series. Woo-hoo. And we dished about our heroine, Ms. Mary Godwin, later Mary Shelley. Jason, do you want to catch us up on what you remember from last week?
I was thinking about this morning, and I just, what I mostly remember is what a roller coaster ride I had with William Godwin, the dad. I remember that you should wear gloves when sticking your hand up someone's vagina.
Yes.
I remember that. I remember poor Mary Godwin, later Shelley, had a really, really shitty childhood. Mm. She lost her amazing, revolutionary, feminist mother in childbirth. She died just a couple days after she was born, so she never even knew her, but she was kind of obsessed with her. And her dad, cold, but still loving. Then we got introduced to the Bish, Percy Bish, who was older and married.
Yes.
And swept her off her feet.
Yes.
Like literally, like in the middle of the night.
On a dark and stormy night, perhaps.
Yeah. To go to, remind me, Switzerland?
Ultimately, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ultimately. Okay. Yeah. And I remember that she had a sexy forehead.
Yes. Yes. She did have a very sexy forehead.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and Jane, the little sister Jane.
Yes.
Little half sister, the beauty that had to watch poor Mary lose her virginity to a creepy older guy on her mother's grave.
Yeah.
That, how could I forget that?
Yeah. And the evil stepmother with the green glasses.
See, I think she got a bad rap. I was actually thinking about her this morning, too. She was Mary Jane, right? Yeah. I don't know. She's like an heiress to a bar. Like that's a low bar, you know, like that's not great. Like you don't start out with much and you know, she tried. Times are hard. Yeah. It's the early 1800s. Times are rough. You know, she did well for herself. She married someone that ran in great circles and then she got shit on by all these like, these stuffy, snobby guys that were like, oh, she's not good enough for William. I feel bad for her.
So your team?
Whatever happened?
Team Mary Jane.
Whatever happened to her? I am Team Mary Jane. Whatever happened to her?
We'll talk a little bit more about her. She'll come up again.
Oh, good. Yes. Good. I always imagine her in, I don't know if it's the time period, but like like a bar winch, like a ruffled shirt that's off the shoulders with big heaving bosoms. You know what I mean? Like, I guess that's kind of German beer hall girl. That's how I imagine her, as a German beer hall girl.
I like it. I'm supportive of that.
Cool. Like probably hundreds of years off in a completely different culture, but.
Here's the deal. I read three books about Mary Shelley in the last month. New Romantics by Daisy Hay, The Lady and Her Monsters by Roseanne Montillo, and In Search of Mary Shelley by Fiona Sampson. By the way, you can find our live bibliography at any time if you want to read any of these books at bookshop.org/shop/antiquetea.
Live bibliography. Like that sounds like something from Frankenstein.
It's alive. No, I'm just uploading our sources there.
Amazing. Yeah, it's amazing.
And if you buy a book from there, then we get a small commission. So you'd be supporting us. Please do that.
Yes.
The thing with all of these three books, though, is they tell basically the same story from slightly different angles. The first is like an ensemble biography about all the young radicals in the era. The second focuses a bit more on science and medicine. The third goes more deeply into Mary's psyche and motivations, but they're all, none of them are centered around Bysshe.
Yeah.
They all talk about Bysshe, since he's such a huge part of Mary's deal and he's part of that zeitgeist, but they never get into his story. So I could tell you facts about Bysshe and their timeline together, but without knowing his motivations, it was maddening because he does so many weird things, but it's not clear to me, it wasn't clear to me at all why he did any of those things.
You know, after last episode, I was thinking about the Bysshe, and because I knew this one was going to be... was going to be about Percy Bysshe. And so I was like, you know, they were so in love. They got swept off. And I kept thinking like, is it going to end poorly? Like, is she going to hate him? And so like, I'm very excited to know. I feel like it could go either way, yeah. Like true love until death or like something horribly messy. Like it's gotta be dramatic. I know it. I just feel it in my gut.
Porque no los dos. Yeah, basically, Bysshe is like a poorly written NPC in a video game. An NPC is somebody that you can't play. They just kind of walk around.
Non-player character?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like someone when you walk up to the German beer wench and she gives you a clue of where to go next.
Exactly. Or if you've seen Jumanji, like the guy on the airplane.
Oh, yeah. Love him.
He
yeah.
was like that. He drives the story, but like why he does what he does, or it didn't make any sense. So I got a biography on Bysshe, and I am so glad I did, because this book, which is called Shelley, The Pursuit by Richard Holmes, it's the page-turningest book out of all the ones I read for this series, in the sense that it was an endless series of, like, head slaps and what the fucks.
Okay.
So I wanted to spend this episode doing a deep dive into Bysshe's life before he sweeps Mary away in the middle of the night.
You're going to dish?
On Bysshe.
You're going to dish on the Bysshe.
Actually, in my notes, I titled this episode Bysshe.
Bysshe.
We'll see if that okay. sticks.
I like it.
So we know about Shelley from excerpts, mainly those of us who took high school classes that made us read his poetry, or like the romantic lit class I took in college. If I were a better scholar, I would have read, you know, Queen Mab and all of the other big famous Shelley poems, but they're like book length, and I'm sorry. This is about the person, not the poetry. We're not going to get into like a deep dive of how he wrote and what his references were, you know?
And honestly, there is a point where if a poem is so long that it needs its own book, it's prose. Like, it, you know, it's moved on. It's moved on beyond poetry. If it's hundreds of pages, I'm sorry.
Well, go, it's prose. Go have a fight with Chaucer, and I'll see you afterwards.
Yeah.
The common perception of Shelley in history, if you look at the Mary Shelley biographies that I read, or how he's portrayed in films, for example, is he's sort of this ethereal love fairy. He's too good for this world. He's a gentle, long-suffering lyric poet.
And is that how it's perceived that she saw him?
Well.
Or like everyone, the world.
That's how...
Or both.
Like if you read the little blurb in your English textbook before you read To a Skylark, it would say something like that. And when he was written about for close to 100 years, because we're talking 200 years ago, was his life, that's how he was portrayed. But you bring up something really interesting. That is exactly how Mary would have written about him, or wrote about him. I don't want to give away who dies at the end.
I mean, well, it's 200 years ago, so they all die at the
fair.
End.
Fair. Okay.
Right.
This guy was so controversial in his day that there was no real biographical material on him released until after 30 years after he died.
That's wild.
People who knew him suppressed and sometimes destroyed written relics of his past.
Were they afraid of him?
They were afraid that his poetic reputation would be indelibly tarnished by his personal reputation.
Whoa.
So when people did write about him 30 years after he died, there was a huge amount of spin on it.
Sure.
Because that was the only way his poems were going to get published. And I'll be the first to admit, I have read excerpts of some of these massive poems. And some of them I'm not crazy about, but the later ones especially can be really beautiful. So I'm glad that they're not gone, you know, but I think it says something about him that that spin had to exist.
Wow. Wow.
Isn't that nuts?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, today it's like when you hear about, it's like Kevin Spacey, mm-hmm. right? Like such an amazing actor. And then you find out he's like this weird sex offender and you're like, oh, well, I don't like him anymore. And it like taints your image of him as like when you go back and watch American Beauty,
totally.
You're like, ugh, but he's like a weird molester guy.
Yeah. You know, it's going to be interesting going through this because we talked last week about how certain things that were okay in the early 1800s are horrifying today and vice versa.
Sure.
Things like serial monogamy were horrifying in the 1810s, but not a big deal today, right? We've both had multiple long-term committed relationships consecutively, right?
Right.
So it's going to be your job as we go through this to try to figure out your feelings about Bish. Did he deserve the level of malignment that he got? Or was it perfectly deserved?
Okay.
You know, would you like him if you met him today?
Right. I'm ready to judge the fuck out of the bitch.
All right. Well, he's born August 4th, 1792. And he spends his early years in a place called Field House in Sussex. So instead of being born in the city, like Mary, he's born in an estate in the country.
Oh, yeah. He's rich.
Mm-hmm. His parents are landed gentry, meaning they don't have a fancy title like Earl or Duke, but their name has a lot of historical resonance in Sussex, and they owned enough property that nobody ever really had to work. Right? You inherit, you get an allowance, you're good to go.
God, it's the dream.
I know. The thing is, though, they're living this dream, but they know how delicately they're clinging on to it. His particular branch of the Shelley family were sort of like nouveau riche gentry. Their name had had standing for a very long time, but the family had gotten very poor and they'd lost their social status. And it was only in Bish's grandfather's generation that they were able to regain it. So his family, and this is going to come up over and over again, his family is hyper careful to maintain their social status because it was so hard earned and they're so deeply aware of how fast it can disappear. So both of his parents, Dad Timothy and Mom Elizabeth, could be described as easygoing conformists. They don't want to rock the boat. They just want to keep what they have and pass it on to the next generation.
Great. I mean, they're like nouveau. I don't even know. I don't know what I'm trying to say. They're
nouveau aristo.
Yeah, I know. I was like, is that? But they're like nouveau aristo.
Yes.
Because they were, and then they weren't, and then they are again.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Hmm.
He does have a couple of sisters, just like Mary Shelley's brothers. We're not going to mention them again.
Charles and William.
Well, we will mention Elizabeth, his sister Elizabeth. The others we don't care about. They are lost to history as far as I'm concerned. He's got a really big imagination. So he's the oldest of all the siblings, and he loves his siblings describe him almost as a magician. He likes reading spooky children's books to them. He plays pranks. He comes up with stories about giant creatures that live in the woods, like a giant tortoise. And he has, by all accounts, a really nice childhood. He gets along really well with his parents. Everything's great. But at the age of 10, he started to get a little bit more, is it mischievous or mischievous?
I think it depends on where you grow up.
Well,
I say mischievous.
And we'll go with mischievous. He starts getting more and more mischievous, and they've got a lot of kids in the house. So when he's 10, he's sent away to Sion House Academy, which we'll call his middle school, doubling back.
Sion House
Academy.
That just sounds like an insane asylum.
It's pretty awful. I mean, he goes from this big estate in the country with fields and woods and a lake to a city building where the only place he has to play is within the imposing stone walls of the courtyard.
Mm, good times. And why? So I'm sorry, I missed it a second ago. Why is he sent there?
If I remember right.
Because he's mischievous. He's mischievous.
Yeah, they've got a bunch of kids at this point. He's starting to act up a little bit, so they send him to Scion House.
There was no record of what he did?
Nothing significant enough that I wrote it down.
Okay. Okay.
I mean.
But they sent him to this shithole in the city.
But not as a punishment. It's like a pre-prep school.
Okay.
So it was more just they're trying to get him his education. They could do that effectively by sending him there.
Okay. But culture change, whole world change.
Massive culture shock. So he's the only sort of upper class person there. Everybody else is the child of a middle class London merchant. So he kind of sticks out. I got a physical description of him from that book, Shelley, A Pursuit. He had a long face with the marked Shelley nose and brow and a ruddy, freckled country child complexion. His eyes were large, blue, staring. His hair was longer than most of the London boys wore it and curled and tangled around his face. His hands and features were fine, with that characteristic girlish delicacy of bone structure belonging to English upper-class children.
I'm telling you, I got some straight-up gaydar when I Googled him last time. Like, he is a delicate looking man.
Maybe part of the takeaway is that much of the upper class will hit your gaydar pretty strong.
Well, you know, when you don't have to do anything... Mm-hmm. You know, you're soft and gentle and like you don't have to do any chores.
Yeah.
Everything's done for you. There's no edge. You don't get an edge to you at all.
No. Essentially, he's the weird kid there. He looks different, he acts different, and he leans into it, if accidentally. So he gets more and more into ghost stories and monsters and demons. He's living in his imagination. And he also gets really into science. Now, not in a hard science way where he's, you know, trying to recreate what Newton did or doing hard math in a notebook, but in kind of a science fiction way. He's really excited about the possibilities of science. And he likes to make up experiments and run them and build devices, almost like a mad scientist kind of thing.
Okay.
This does not endear you to a bunch of little bros. So he gets beat up horribly and frequently.
Aww.
He's the pariah of the school. He's got one friend who's an underclassman, and the two of them are just sort of mocked together. Now, he may have had that characteristic girlish delicacy of bone structure belonging to English upper-class children, but he also inherited his grandfather Bish's temper, and he's known for lashing out with a violent rage when he gets angry. So I want to take a quick sidetrack and talk a little bit about Grandpa Bish, because he's an interesting character.
Don't we all?
I know.
Don't we all want to talk about Grandpa Bish?
So, our Bish's great-granddad moved from Sussex to the New World when the colonies were newish, and he became a quack doctor selling tinctures and remedies.
Huh. So I assume this is around the time, or this is when the Bish family name was not at the top of its game.
Yeah.
If you're a quack doctor
In New York.
Fucking New World. Yeah.
This is just pre-revolution, too. Like, he probably moves out there in the early mid-1700s.
Yeah, it's a rough time in the States. Yeah.
He gives birth to Bish Shelley, Grandpa. I love that Bish Shelley was born in Newark, New Jersey. I'm a Jersey girl. So that's my little connection to the Shelleys.
Hey.
And he was determined to get his family name back. So, in 1752, he starts a tradition by eloping with a 16-year-old.
Now, are you just saying that because the Arbish did it?
Yes.
Did the father in between them do it, too?
Not that I'm aware of. I think he married...
Skips a generation. Yeah. Marrying a 16-year-old and skips
every other Shelley elopes with a 16-year-old.
Like male pattern baldness.
It's a genetic thing. It just skips every now and then. So, he's born in Newark. Elopes with a 16-year-old in 1752. She was an heiress, but she died 9 years later. She died really young, and he inherited...
Perfect.
I know. He gets all of her money.
Perfect.
Doesn't have to deal with her anymore.
Oh, God, the dream. Living the dream.
Man, it's Bish. And then he does the same thing, marries another 16-year-old a few years later. But in this case, not to get money, but to get more social status. So he's moving up like the social rungs with this second relationship.
So she's high social status, but not like super rich. Well, he's already rich.
He's already rich. Yeah.
Okay. But she's probably rich too.
Probably. Yeah.
If she's high social status.
I mean, he definitely.
And they're still in New York.
No, they move back to Sussex when he marries the 16-year-old.
Okay. Which 16-year-old?
The first one.
Okay.
He moves back and then elopes with the 16-year-old. Ugh. And he was kind of a miser, which is how you get really rich. He lived in a little cottage near Fieldhouse.
No way.
He used to hide money in his furniture. When he died, they found £12,816 in cash hidden in, like, the folds of his sofa. So this is a description of Bish when he's at school by one of the schoolmasters. Even at that age, he exhibited considerable poetical talent, accompanied by a violent and extremely excitable temper, which manifested itself in all kinds of eccentricities. His imagination was always roving upon something romantic and extraordinary, such as spirits, fairies, fighting, volcanoes, etc. And he not infrequently astonished his schoolfellows by blowing up the boundary palings of the playground with gunpowder, and also the lid of his desk in the middle of school time.
Jeez, he just, I feel like maybe sending him to Scion House Academy is not really working.
No.
To tamper down the mischievousness. Yeah. I love that also in his, that was like his parent-teacher conference report. I love that it was, he was into fairies and volcanoes.
Yes.
Like what? Love it.
Well, this is also when he discovers Pulp Fiction from Minerva Press.
Oh.
So he finds a little shop nearby that sells these horror books and gothic romance books, and he becomes obsessed with those, collects them. He also suffers from strange dreams, and he's a big sleepwalker.
Oh, sleepwalking is one of my nightmares.
Like the idea of doing it, or do you sleepwalk when you...
That's the end. That's the whole story. It's like in running into a sleepwalker, me sleepwalking, the idea of anyone sleepwalking is... I had a time where I was having, I have insomnia now, but there was a time where I was really desperate and my doctor was like, well, I can give you a prescription to Ambien.
Oh, no.
But then he goes through the things. He's like, but sometimes I've had patients that sleepwalk or sleep eat or sleep drive. And I was like, done.
So
I'm done. Sleep drive?
I went to visit a friend of mine from high school. She was living in an apartment in New York for college. And she was living with another friend of ours from high school. And I walk in with my bags. I've come up from Maryland where I'm studying. And our mutual friend, a guy, walks out of his room naked except for a pair of tidy whities, rubbing Vicks Vapor Rub on his nipples and talking about it. And it was because he had taken an Ambien. That was how I saw him again.
Yeah.
Yeah. The biggest feeling, the biggest like takeaway from this Scion House experience for him was a feeling of betrayal. He'd been really close with his mom, and after he went to Scion House, she slowly stopped writing, stopped getting back in touch.
Bish.
So it's him against the world. His family is leaving him, school is tyrannical, and he decides at that age that he's going to fight against tyranny. In fact, he remembers the very moment he decided to fight for justice. Brrrm, in verse. Are you ready?
Yes.
I do remember well the hour which burst my spirit's sleep, a fresh May, dawn it was, when I walked forth upon the glittering grass and wept, I knew not why, till there rose from the near schoolroom voices that, alas, were but one echo from a world of woes, the harsh and grating strife of tyrants and of foes. And then I clasped my hands and looked around, but none was near to mock my streaming eyes, which poured their warm drops on the sunny ground. So without shame, I spake, I will be wise and just and free and mild, if in me lies such power, for I grow weary to behold the selfish and the strong still tyrannize without reproach or check. I then controlled my tears, my heart grew calm, and I was meek and bold.
Are you sure you didn't read that from the script of Dead Poets Society?
It reads like that, right?
It does, right, yeah.
Well, we're going to find as we go through this that Shelley rewrites his history a lot. He sort of mythologizes his past.
If you can do it, do it.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I don't doubt that he sort of made this decision as a kid, fine.
Yeah.
I don't think he did it in in the form of a, you know, 90s feel-good boarding school movie.
Right. Just give me a boombox and over my head and I'm good to go. No, that's the wrong kind of movie.
The reality of his life then was obviously a lot more messy, because it's documented that he took his big feelings home with him when he went home for the holidays. And like so many men, and sometimes women, who aren't taught how to talk about their emotions, or when they live in a place where it's not okay to, your big feelings make you feel big things, and then you do big, stupid things. Yeah?
Yep.
So while he was sort of a benign, creative magician to his siblings before, now he's hard to control. He's more violent. He makes gunpowder devices and fire balloons. His clothes were always stained from playing with chemicals and acids from his chemistry sets.
I feel like maybe some of the grown-ups should put a little onus on themselves and stop making gunpowder available to him.
There is that.
You mentioned a lot of gunpowder experiments. Like, where is he getting this gunpowder?
I would love to know. I wonder if it's like cigarettes in the 60s, where like, even if you're a little kid, you can just pop over to the corner store and be like, I'd like a dram of gunpowder, please.
Right. Or like, hey, Johnny, I snuck this gunpowder off my mom's purse. Let's go blow something up.
Oh, my God. So he goes from Scion House when he graduates to Eton College, which is a very high class prep school. It's like Eton and Harrow are the big two. The morning he leaves home, his family discovers that he's set a fire in the bathroom with one of his chemical preparations.
Jeez.
So things aren't boding super well.
No.
He's at Eton for 6 years, and things don't start out great there either, because he is a little bit of a weirdo. He's still an outcast. He's known as Mad Shelley by his schoolmates. A schoolmate wrote at the time, many a cruel torture was practiced upon him for his moody and singular exclusiveness. Conscious of his own superiority, of being the reverse of what the many deemed him, stung by the injustice of imputed madness, his rage became boundless. His heartless tyrants all but raised up the demon which they said was in him. I have seen him surrounded, hooted, baited like a maddened bull. And at this distance of time, I seem to hear ringing in my ears the cry which Shelley was wont to utter in his paroxysms of revengeful anger.
Jeez. That's from a fellow classmate.
Yes. Now, I don't want to go too much into, you know, boarding school politics, but the place is not set up for good relationships. So
it's not like Dead Poets Society. Is that what you're saying?
The thing that I remember from reading about this, and I don't have it in my notes in front of me, so sorry if I get some of this wrong, but when you're an underclassman, like a first year or a second year, you're assigned to an upperclassman.
Right.
To what's called fag for them. So in addition to your schoolwork and everything else that you have to do on a day-to-day basis, you have to be their personal manservant.
What?
Yeah.
That's wild. Man, people were so weird.
I know.
Huh.
I have another example of cruelty while he's there. The boys often invited him to rehearse these productions, these plays that he's written, with a mock interest. And then, just when he thought the audience were thoroughly enraptured, burst out into fits of laughter.
Wait a second. Everybody would pretend to like his plays, mm-hmm. and then they would just like laugh at them. Like, oh, they mm-hmm. would, oh, no.
Now, Bish is not an innocent either.
Well, no. I mean, we've covered gunpowder, so. But that's so mean.
It is.
Like, that's so mean. Like, they were really putting on the play?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. They were reading it, doing a dry read at least.
Oh, okay. Still.
Still. I think I said this last time and I stand by it. If we were to go through a trauma survey that you give to, like, an adult who had suffered childhood trauma, I think that all of the characters in this story, all of the people we're dishing on, would qualify for CPTSD.
Yeah.
And we can do that at the end. Like, I've gone through the list with some of the people just for fun, and it applies.
The crazy thing, too, is that you said that his childhood was great. He loved his mom. He grew up in the country. Mm-hmm. He was sweet with his sisters. That's wild. I mean, that's something inside of him. I think that his parents reacted to that.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly schooling that sent him out of control for this period.
Yeah. Jeez.
When I say that he was not innocent, he told a friend once that he had been provoked into striking a penknife through the hand of one of his tormentors and pinning it through the desk. He also continued his experiments, so he electrified his housemaster with a wired-up doorknob, accidentally, but still. He was discovered once again by his housemaster in his dorm room in a circle of blue alcohol flame trying to raise the devil.
Okay. Okay. yeah, no. I don't feel so bad for him anymore.
He was also still blowing up stuff with gunpowder. Finally, the school takes away his chemistry books.
Yeah, and where's he getting the gunpowder at school?
I don't know. I wish I knew.
That's crazy. So I think maybe his time at Eton could possibly be great material for a sitcom.
Go on.
Now, hear me out. An all boys boarding school with a cast of different, like, personalities. Mm-hmm. And then he'd be the wacky, sort of like eccentric, crazy prankster.
Like the Kramer.
But if we got it on TV, they probably wouldn't let us blow up so much stuff and electrocute headmasters. But...
Well, you know, there's network and there's HBO.
Perfect. Okay, we'll pitch it to HBO. So he's fucking shit up. And is this by the time he's... Like, is this all in the first year?
I sort of mushed together his Eton years just for simplicity.
But they didn't kick him out.
No. He gets sent home once because he has a bad fever. He later describes that incident as having been expelled twice. So again, he's a little bit of a fabulist.
Yeah.
It's during this time that we start to see where some of his personality characteristics come from. His fear of being alone, of being rejected, unaccepted. He's got a fear of his own violence. You know, he knows he's capable of it and he doesn't like it.
Aww.
He also, though, develops this deep-seated hatred of institutions. And his way of reacting to it is by being kind of flamboyant, right? Being an exhibitionist, being daring. And part of that is this interest in the occult, which he's still into. He'd stay up all night watching for ghosts. Will try to do rituals like carrying a skull out into a field. He probably got the skull where he got the gunpowder. I don't know.
Right. Just in the broom closet at Eton.
Yeah. And it makes sense because his favorite person at Eton was this guy named Dr. James Lind. This guy used to be a personal physician to royalty, a scholar, a traveler, and an eccentric. He's also rumored to be an amateur demonologist, and he collects, like, hermetic texts.
Amateur demonologist.
I know.
That's amazing.
During this period, he would wander around, chanting the demonic formula from Southey's poem Curse of Kahama while staring at other students. So he'd wander around going, "And water shall see thee and fear thee and fly thee. The waves shall not touch thee as they pass by thee."
Oh, bish.
He'd also mutter bits of Macbeth or Rime of the Ancient Mariner under his breath and then punctuate it with like, and then go back to muttering.
Oh, what a loser.
He's a teenage goth.
Yeah. But like the kind of goth that no one likes. There's like the good goth and then the obnoxious goth. So I have to say that the small bit that we covered about the Bish last episode, I feel my jaw's on the ground. Like if you'd given me a multiple choice question about what did you think after me learning the little bit about Bish that I had last week, if you'd given me a multiple choice question about what was he into when he was in high school, and one of the answers had, and if the correct answer had been in the occult, I would have thought that was the joke answer.
Oh,
like I don't know, like the wispy hair and the soft, and he was like radical ideas, but like, they're big ideas, but nothing really concrete. Mm-hmm. They were more about like, I would not have pegged him for a electric doorknob occult guy.
This is how I picture him. I knew people when I was in high school, disaffected boys primarily, who were really into like Tool. And would hang out wearing all black in the basement of the school and like ostentatiously carry around a copy of Sartre, you know, who are trying to simultaneously do this like ultra intelligent but dark. They'd be really into Chuck Palahniuk.
I don't know who that is.
Like Fight Club.
Oh.
Those books, yeah. Right? They tell everybody to watch Requiem for a Dream because it's like inspired. No. I knew this kid. I can picture him so clearly in my head. So I can, you know, I think when, especially when you've been made fun of so much as a kid, you want to put on this mask, right? This protective mask. And sometimes a protective mask is very visibly obvious, like it's Liberty Spikes, right? Or bondage pants or a vinyl prom dress, right?
Right. Let's move over here from away from them. You don't really think they're dangerous, but you just, it's obviously for attention, but it's just weird enough to make you feel nervous.
I think it's actually more about deflection. Like, I think the kids who do that are so uncomfortable and so insecure. And I say this because I was borderline this kid, that they're shocking to kind of push people away. And then if people don't want to be friends with them, they can blame it on those other people.
Yeah. Blame the institution that nobody likes them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really the scary kids are the ones that are quiet.
Yeah.
Like the Columbine kids, like they were quiet. Nobody.
Yeah.
They were weird, but quiet.
Yeah, this guy is he needs some therapy. He needs some therapy. That's all it is. He needs some therapy and like to be introduced to Jeff Buckley and he'll be fine.
I love Jeff Buckley.
Me too.
That's awesome. Yeah, he needs a little of that.
Mm-hmm. In addition to reading about magic during this time, he's starting to get his own ideas about the tyranny of authority and specifically the tyranny of religion. Now, you know my favorite word, Jason. My favorite word is nudge. And I feel like I need to define this because a lot of people that I've said it to are like, what do you mean? A nudge is somebody who gets great joy out of like poking somebody and making them kind of uncomfortable and seeing that discomfort. People who enjoy saying things or doing things to make other people squirm a little bit. That's nudgy behavior or being a nudge. Shelley is a nudge.
Yeah. With gunpowder.
Well, and in this case with the Postal Service. So following Lynn's lead, Lynn had done this when he was younger. He'd pretend to be like a little old lady in the country, and he'd write famous experts with religious or philosophical questions. And he'd start out really, you know, tell me, will I be saved if I, you know, really easy questions. And he gradually entraps them into bigger and bigger, more controversial questions of faith or politics. He loved doing this.
So he was a religious catfisher?
Kinda. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'd have this going with several people at once. He loved seeing other people pissed off.
But this is all through letters.
This is all through letters.
Fucking letters, man.
I know.
So many letters back then.
By the end of his time at Eton, he graduates at 18 in 1810. He wasn't loved per se, but he was tolerated, finally, as being basically the resident benign eccentric.
He got through.
People recognize that he's good at the classics. He's really good with Latin. In fact, he translated the first 15 books of Pliny's Historia Naturalis into English from Latin.
So was he a good student? I mean, did he graduate with good grades?
I mean, he was really good at what he was good at. People saw that he was writing poetry and they encouraged that. I think the big thing for him was classics, like reading old Greek and Latin books and doing translations.
And have you seen any of his poetry because I haven't read any really of his poetry, but what you read to me before, I mean, it's very flowery and very, you know, dew on the ground. And but like, I mean, this, I just imagine him writing about, I don't know, like death and the occult. And I mean, that would be the poetry from high, especially when you're a teenager. Was there any work from that was recovered from his teen years?
Oh, yes.
Excellent.
So you asked about his poetry and writing at the time, and I have some excerpts for you, my friend.
Oh, my God. Please bring it on.
So he publishes his first couple of books around, like, between his last year at Eton and his first year at Oxford. One of these things that got published was a Gothic romance called a Gothic romance called Zastrozzi.
Okay.
Which is very typical. Long-suffering hero, evil villain, a blonde virginal heroine, and an evil slutty heroine. So this is an excerpt from that story. "Die, detested wretch," exclaimed Matilda in a paroxysm of rage as she violently attempted to bathe the stiletto in the lifeblood of her rival. But Julia starting aside, the weapon slightly wounded her neck and the exsanguined stream stained her alabaster bosom. She fell on the floor, but suddenly starting up, attempting to escape her bloodthirsty persecutor. Nerved anew by this futile attempt to escape her vengeance, the ferocious Matilda seized Julia's floating hair and, holding her back with fiend-like strength, stabbed her in a thousand places and with exulting pleasure again and again buried the dagger to the hilt in her body, even after all remains of life were annihilated. At last, the passions of Matilda, exhausted by their own violence, sank into a deadly calm. She threw the dagger violently from her and contemplated the terrific scene before her with a sullen gaze.
I have no words to that. I thought it might change halfway through. I was like, it's going to change now. And then it didn't. It got worse. To me, that's a little bit of... To me, that is... There's a clear layer of falsehood on that. It's clearly so made up. Like, I feel like the scary or the dramatic or the shocking is it's fabricated. It doesn't feel seeped in any kind of earnesty.
No.
And so it comes off as two-dimensional. And then also I think he just was horny too. There's a lot of horniness in there, which was gross.
So this is part of the plot. The hero falls in love with both women, one sexually, the other platonically. And then when he's confronted by them together, he swoons, then wakes up and orgasmically stabs himself to death.
So he definitely was gay.
Maybe, I don't know. Someone did a psychoanalytic study on this story and decided that Shelley was an introspective schizoid type with arrested sexual development and homosexual tendencies.
Oh, my God. So I probably have a PhD and I don't even know it.
Could be.
I pretty much, that's what I've been saying about him.
Yeah. He also wrote some poems. And this poem that I'm going to read you, Jason, has the best name ever. It's called Gasta, or The Avenging Demon, with 3 exclamation points.
Three? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that we'll move on. Just edit that out.
Okay. Now I won't, but all right. So I'm going to read this to you. "Light the cloud as summer fog, which transient shuns the morning beam, fleeting as the cloud on bog that hangs or on the mountain stream. Horror seized my shuddering brain. Horror dimmed my starting eye. In vain I tried to speak. In vain my limbs essayed the spot to fly. At last the thin and shadowy form with noiseless, trackless footsteps came. Its light robe fluttered on the storm. Its head was bound with lambent flame. In chilling voice, drear as the breeze, which sweeps along the autumnal ground, which wanders through the leafless trees, or the mandrake's groan which floats around. Thou art mine, and I am thine, till the sinking of the world. I am thine, and thou art mine, till in ruin death is hurled."
It just sounds like Edgar Allan Poe fan fiction.
I'll tell you exactly what this sounds like. I was the editor or a co-editor of my high school literary magazine. And we got so many submissions like this that my friend and I started a game one year where we tried to write the best bad teen angst poetry to see if it would get in.
Fantastic.
This read like what we came up with.
Yeah.
All I remember from my poem, I'll see if I can find it. There was the line, "My tears go drip, drop, drip, plop upon the cold cement of life."
Oh, it wasn't too bad until you said plop. The drip, drop, drip. I was like, okay, that's cheesy. And then plop, that killed it.
Well, it was supposed to be bad.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, bravo then.
Yeah.
Bravo. Okay. So, I mean, that poem was interesting. It was better than the story.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't.
I do.
I mean, the story I can read as like sort of like pulp horror fan fiction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just a pastiche of stuff that's out there already.
Yeah.
The poem is pretty close to unforgivable as far as I'm concerned. Maybe I've read too many things like that.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think it was good, but I would, if I only had one thing to read for the rest of my life, I'd probably choose the poem versus the story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've got one other extant piece of writing from 1810-ish. This is a letter that he wrote to his friend, and he's telling his friend that he's going to be in the area. These are his instructions to his friend for what to do when they meet. And obviously, this isn't real. He's just fantasizing.
But this is a real letter he sent to his friend?
Mm-hmm.
So is he like just nudging them?
I think he's just letting his imagination, he's using it as a creative writing exercise.
Hmm.
I mean, you're going to hear this, and obviously it's not real instructions.
How old is he at this point?
18.
18, okay. Mm-hmm. And his friend is?
Presumably about the same age, I don't know.
But, okay, because I imagine him with not too many friends, so.
There were some family friends. I think this guy, so this friend is called Edward Graham. And if I remember right, I didn't take extensive notes on him, but he's sort of a family friend, and he hangs out with him and his sister. They've known each other since childhood. It's that kind of thing.
But he's not an Eton boy.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Okay.
He writes to Edward, "Stalk along the road towards them, and mind and keep concealed as my mother brings a blood-stained stiletto, which she purposes to make you bathe in the lifeblood of her enemy. Never mind the death demons and skeletons dripping with the putrefaction of the grave that occasionally may blast your straining eyeball. Persevere even though hell and destruction should yawn beneath your feet. Think of all this at the frightful hour of midnight, when the hell demon leans over your sleeping form and inspires those thoughts which eventually will lead you to the gates of destruction."
Was his friend's letter back like, "Sorry, I'm busy that night"?
I don't know.
Like, no, that was rough. That was rough.
Whenever I read this, you know how you and I use the same teenage boy voice?
Oh, yeah.
I hear it in my head with that. Stalk along the road towards them,
God.
And mind and keep concealed as my mother.
Your bloody stiletto.
I mean, I still feel like I know this kid.
Wow. Wow.
So from here, from Eton, he moves on to Oxford in 1810. Now, what do you think of when we talk about people who go to Oxford now?
Smart, stuffy.
Yeah, really hard smart, to get into, right?
Smart and stuffy, yeah, and like elite.
Yeah, very challenging academically.
Mm-hmm.
1810, Oxford, there are no major responsibilities for the upper class. His only academic responsibilities were to attend chapel daily, translate a news article into Latin once a week, and see his tutor once per term.
Like he didn't have any, what?
Mm-hmm.
That was college?
That's college, that's it. His bigger responsibility as a member of the country gentry is to be a good party host. So basically, there's no intellectual life at Oxford, but there's a big social life. He's expected to go whoring, go drinking, go sporting, as long as he reads the classics a little bit in between.
Wait, so Oxford used to be like a Greek school. It used to be like a frat and sorority school. It used to be a party school.
Totally. Cambridge, too.
It's like Florida State.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Isn't that bizarre?
Huh.
But maybe a little bit less so because at this point it's still a religious institution that's run by bishops. So there's this like veneer of.
Yeah.
I think you basically go if you're a nobleman, because if you're not gentry, you do actually have to do work. It's only the title of people where they don't give a shit.
Right.
For them, it's kind of like the equivalent of going to get your MRS, except maybe it's your LORD.
That's fantastic.
Now, his dad knows this about Oxford, so he gave him some advice before he left, knowing that Percy's going to have the opportunity to go crazy. And this is going to be important later. He says he would provide for as many children as Bysshe chose to get, but that he would never forgive him for making a mésalliance. And I had to look that word up, but basically it means would never forgive him for marrying down socially.
Yeah. So you can have 100 kids, but if I don't like your wife, if your wife is poor, then...
Yeah.
You're done to me?
I mean, I think the implication is if you're going to fuck those girls, have kids out of wedlock.
Oh.
And I'll support them.
Damn, Dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then that's exactly... Bysshe. He's got a rail against the he's got a rail against the man and his father, because that's exactly what he did. I remember from last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's raging against the machine. And the biggest part of the machine right now is Oxford.
Yeah.
He sees it as a tyrannical bullshit institution that isn't forcing him to learn. So he decides to be the most learned, outrageous student in all of Oxford. And his schedule looked something like this. He'd read 16 hours a day, sleep between 6 and 10 p.m., curled up like a dog on a rug in front of the fire, and then wake up and do natural philosophy experiments all night.
He has no time to blow things up with gunpowder, though. Is that not on the schedule?
Oh, that's what he's doing at night with the natural philosophy experiments.
Oh, natural philosophy yeah. experiments, quote, quote.
He's doing hard science, quote, quote.
Okay, interesting. It feels like maybe he's had a shift here.
Well, he's definitely moving from the occult being his primary obsession
mm-hmm.
and natural philosophy
yeah.
towards something more real life. So the analogy I would make is that weird kid we knew from high school. And I say weird with all the affection in the world, because
yeah.
again,
yeah.
I could tell you stories, who goes to college, decides they want to be perceived a little bit differently. And so they become the Marley kid who's fighting for social justice, or they become the extreme vegan, or they become, you know, the PETA protester who will throw something on your leather jacket and try to rip it with a knife. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, he's having a shift. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that makes sense. I mean, the occult stuff and the supernatural stuff, that's, he doesn't know what to rail against and what to embrace. So something supernatural feels, you know, it feels rebellious when you're
sure.
walking around muttering fucking weird incantations and then laughing.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I mean, that seems like a logical next step for him.
And I want to be clear when I say, like, your PETA friend who knifes up your leather jackets, or your vegan friend who won't eat at your house because you cooked meat once in your stove. Like, these are not bad causes. I'm all for being vegan.
Yeah.
I'm all for caring about animal rights. But you know that there are some people who make that cause their identity. And
yeah.
through living by their own very, very hard standards, you know, people who are polemical about this, right? And their whole life is defined by that single issue. They can be really unintentionally cruel.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Like, they can do something that to them they can rationalize perfectly well because it aligns with their ethics. But they're being a dick, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Which is no way to get someone to, you know,
no.
get enlightened on whatever your cause is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, he does find a friend when he goes to Oxford. Finally,
yay.
He meets this guy, Thomas Jefferson Hogg.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
he had the
I
quote from
him.
The last episode.
Yeah.
So he's also 18. He also shared a dislike of authority, a love of nudging experts, and a taste for the outrageous. So this is another description from Shelley, A Pursuit. Hogg was a broad, stocky figure beside Shelley's tall, elegant outline, and a silhouette of him wearing the academical tasseled cap shows a curling, rather supercilious lip and a fine, prominent Roman nose, with his head tilted in a sharply inquisitorial manner. His background was very different from Shelley's, coming from solid professional middle-class stock in northern England, where his father, John Hogg, was a lawyer. There was something curiously gullible and bovine about Hogg's temperament, which made him both a loyal admirer of Shelley's extravagance and the perfect, tireless audience for Shelley's nocturnal fantasies and speculative monologues.
Yeah, that's a classic character. Like, chunky, admiring sidekick.
Totally.
Yeah.
And again, I have been that person. So as we talk about Shelley's relationship with Hogg, I'm going to pepper in my own experience, because I have too been entranced by the wild and crazy friend who's going to make your life more exciting, but only if you stay subservient to them.
Yeah.
And only if you go along with it. Right?
Oh, yeah.
You have to have them in control.
Absolutely.
I think there's a fine line in that kind of relationship between relishing the audacity of your over-the-top friend and then cringing at some of the things they do. And I think the same thing is true of Bish and Hog. So on the one hand, they'd sail paper boats whenever they found a body of water. Bish was, like, obsessed with this. He'd fold up cash into paper boats and put them in fountains and on streams. And
cash?
Yeah. And other papers, but often cash.
Oh, Bish.
They'd wander around. Yeah. They'd wander around turning the daily moments of life into episodes out of a picaresque comedy like Don Quixote. So it's making daily life more exciting.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Shelley would do things that would make you cringe, like grabbing a baby out of its mom's arms and quizzing it loudly on Platonic philosophy.
What?
Yep. And I remember the same thing. You know, I met...
Grabbing babies?
No, but almost, well, differently bad. You know, this friend that I'm referring to had some good qualities. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been friends with her, you know?
Yeah.
And she did have that picaresque comedy element to her life. Everything seemed more exciting. But I remember being at the mall once, standing on the balcony above the food court, and my friend started shouting down at people in the food court, loudly criticizing their clothes. Mm. Like, hey, bitch, your pants don't fit.
Yeah.
Another time we were in the hallway and she walked up to our social studies teacher and said, Mr. S, how do you suck a fuck? Just, oh, right. He had a good answer, though. He said, well, you take a long walk off a short pier.
Classic.
There's also an element of control inherent in this. And that's certainly true to my experience, too.
Oh, of the Bish and Hog?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So at one point, Shelley suggests that Hog fall in love with his sister, Elizabeth. Just do it. Just go fall in love with her.
Maybe Hog was in love with Bish.
Well, that's been theorized.
Bish is a pretty boy. Bish is a pretty boy.
I haven't seen any like hard evidence of it yet, but the lines were a lot wobblier then. I mean, I did some reading on queer history in this era, and it seems like it was more about where you put it than who you put it in.
Yeah, yeah.
Sodomy, sure, is what was illegal, right? Not
right.
So it's possible. So he's trying to get Hog to fall in love with Elizabeth. He makes sure that they start a correspondence and they write back and forth all the time. But Hog has to report back to Shelley with his emotions. Like, what are you feeling at the moment? What's going on? At the same time, whenever Hog is in the vicinity of Field Place and he could visit Elizabeth, Shelley doesn't let him.
Man, he's crazy. He is crazy.
There's something wrong.
Yeah, there's something wrong. So he's taken that angsty, weird, occult energy and now is fucking with humans. Like, he's all like, he's smart enough and old enough and more, quote, mature enough or whatever. His brain has developed enough because teenage boys are fucking idiots. And where now he's moved on to, you know, something that feels the occult, it feels magical. And something like, oh, if it's magic, I can control magic. And, you know, I can, these spells and incantations, and I can be in control. But all of a sudden now he has this, admirer, this crony that it looks up to him. And now he can literally control someone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would call Hog an acolyte almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Man. Oh, I'm having a little less sympathy for the Bish.
More and more, they start getting into radical politics. So they're reading a lot of Voltaire, Thomas Paine, Ben Franklin, Rousseau, Adam Smith. And this is where they both discover Godwin as well, William Godwin.
Yeah.
They also both start identifying as atheists.
Interesting.
Now, this is a big deal at the time. So again, from Shelley, a pursuit. At the time, atheism implied immorality, social inferiority, and unpatriotic behavior all in one sweep. During a time of war against the revolutionary forces in Europe, it also implied treachery, revolutionism, and foreign degeneracy.
Jeez, yeah.
Because remember, the French revolutionaries were atheists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I'm an atheist, but I will be the first person to say that there are two broad categories of atheists. There's people like me who don't believe in God, and as such, I don't really think about it much. It holds the same amount of space in my brain as, like, water skiing. I don't water ski, so I don't think about it. You know what I mean?
Right,
it's not a big deal. And I don't proselytize it. Like,
exactly.
As long as you're not hurtful to other people, I don't give a shit what you believe. Now, the other type of atheist can commonly be found among angry 14-year-olds and members of the subreddit r atheism. These are the people who are fanatical about it and try to convert others to atheism with all the zeal of a Pentecostal preacher at a revival.
It's the same thing with the PETA, the vegans. And
totally.
You make it your identity and nobody fucking likes you.
Not like, a single issue voter. You're a single issue human.
Yeah. Like, fuck off. Like, get a personality.
Yep. That's Dish. And you know, Hog.
Like, I like a little spandex in my denim jeans, but, you know, I don't demand that everyone have stretch jeans.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I don't. That was weird. I was buying jeans earlier today.
So, here are some quotes from Shelley's letters around this period. Oh, I burn with... Should I do it with the teenage boy? Or we may have aged out of teenage boy
we
voice.
We may have aged out of teenage. Well, do you ever, though?
All right. Oh, I burn with impatience for the moment of ex-Dianity's dissolution. It has injured me, I swear, on the altar of perjured love to revenge myself. Yet here I swear, and as I break my oath, my infinity eternity blast me. Here I swear that I will never forgive Christianity. Oh, how I wish I were the Antichrist, that it were mine to crush the demon, referring to Jesus, to hurl him to his native hell, never to rise again. I expect to gratify some of this insatiable feeling in poetry.
Ay, ay, ay. Ay, ay, ay. I mean, his weird personality just keeps morphing and morphing and morphing. It's just like whatever is in front of him that can feed that insatiable appetite of I have to throw all my rage at something that can absorb it so it doesn't bounce back on me. It's and it keeps morphing. That's interesting.
I would also like to note that this is the earliest usage I've personally seen of what would later become ex-Tina.
Like Christina Aguilera?
Yeah, because she changed the Christ to ex-Tina. And then you've got Xmas, so he talks about ex-Dianity and ex-t for Christ, which doesn't make sense. It would just be ex, right?
No one, yeah. Huh.
Yeah. So both sets of parents are, of course, horrified. And they're writing to each other at the time. It's very much like the harried phone calls between children's parents trying to sort out what their dumbass kids are doing. And of course, Bish's parents in particular, who are so hyper aware of maintaining this fragile social status that their family has built, are like,
they're
going to
blame it on the hog, aren't they? Are they going to blame it on Hog?
They do for like a minute.
Okay.
But then it becomes clear through Hog's parents who the instigator is.
And they know their kid.
They
I mean,
do.
With the gunpowder and the incidences throughout his whole life, I mean,
they've got to have a picture.
They've got to know.
So one thing leads to another. And Hog, maybe to impress Shelley, looks through a bunch of the stuff he's reading and he develops a proof against God.
Okay.
And these exist. If you look up like debates between, you know, Christians and atheists, for example, you'll see people on both sides have these. But this is a really early one. Shelley loves it. And they decide together to turn it into a pamphlet to be called The Necessity of Atheism.
So I feel like all good revolution or radical stories start with a pamphlet.
Yeah.
I do. I feel like, what do you got? I got a new idea. It's different. I can't say it out loud. I'm going to throw it in a little pamphlet.
Yeah. Well, this is his first little pamphlet, the first of several over the years. And he's written a couple other things. This is going to come up in a quote later. So just know that this isn't the only thing he's written in college. He and Hog have published a couple of anonymous, like, books of poetry. But this is the important one. It's about 1,000 words long. And it's specifically written to be nudgy. It's written with this sort of, like, innocent, go, how could I possibly know that there wasn't a God? But look how clear it is. My logic is so good. You know, that type of vibe.
The Necessity of Atheism. I mean, that's in and of itself the name.
Mm-hmm. It's like, has your kid ever done one of those things where he's done something that has pissed you off and he knows that it's wrong, but he can come up with a legalistic argument for why it's not. And then with a big smile, he presents it to you. I used to do that kind of shit.
I mean, that like is my son. So,
okay.
I mean, yeah.
So that's how this is written. Now, it would have been one thing if they just got it printed and put it in the bookshop, because remember, the print shop and the bookshop are the same.
All in one.
Would have been one thing if they just put it in the shop and left it at that. It was anonymous.
Did they get a soapbox? Are they going to get on a soapbox?
There's no soapbox, no.
And pass it out in the square?
Not quite. I mean, it's anonymous, and no one's going to read this thing, right? Like, the publishing houses are kind of vanity publishers, too. You're paying to get your book printed.
Right, right.
So it goes in the shop. Unfortunately, Shelley has seeded the shop, like mixing in his book among the other books in lots of different places. And 20 minutes after it goes on sale, a reverend who's also a fellow at the university finds it, freaks out, and has all of the remaining copies burned.
Hey, I mean, he hit the ground running with his rebellious ideas.
Well, that would have been the end of it. But Bish is a nudge. And he sent a copy to all of the high muckety mucks who administrated at the college, many of whom were bishops.
So did the Bish know about this preacher or whatever that bought? I assume he bought them all up. And
no, he told the publisher what was in it. And the publisher was like, oh, no, we're not having those on our shelves.
And did the Bish know about this? Like, because I would imagine that would emblazon the Bish.
He became aware of it, but he'd already sent out these copies to all the other people.
Okay.
Like, that was initial plan.
I'm sure that felt amazing that he, like, first thing I publish that's controversial is fucking burned.
Oh, yeah.
It's like,
you know, he loved it.
The goal.
So here's the thing. This has gone from being a not a very big deal to a very big deal. You know, had the bishops and the administration not seen it, it wouldn't have been. But now, instead of, you know, getting sent home for a term, he's looking at being expelled, or even worse.
I thought it was anonymous.
It's pretty fucking obvious who it is.
Okay.
He does not keep his mouth shut.
Okay. Yeah. He's got a personality around.
Mm-hmm. And he's even at risk for being prosecuted for blasphemous libel, which is a law at the time.
Jeez.
So I've got a great quote from this guy, Charles Kilpatrick Sharp. He's an MA of Christ Church College, which is a part of Oxford. And he's writing to his patron, Lord Barry. This is beautiful. This is a beautiful read. Let's put it that way. Talking of books, we have lately had a literary sun shine forth upon us here, before whom our former luminaries must hide their undiminished heads. A Mr. Shelley of University College, who lives upon arsenic, aquafortis, half an hour sleep in the night. He hath published what he terms, and this is one of those other books, her posthumous poems, which I am grieved to say, though stuffed full of treason, is extremely dull. But the author is a great genius, and if he be not clapped up in bedlam or hanged, will certainly prove one of the sweetest swans on the tuneful margin of the Cherwell. That's a river that goes through it. Our Apollo Next came out with a prose pamphlet in praise of atheism, which I have not yet seen. And there appeared a monstrous romance in one volume called The Rosicrucian. All the heroes are confirmed robbers and causeless murderers, while the heroines glide en chemise through the streets of Geneva, tap at the palazzo doors of their sweethearts, and on being denied admittance, leave no card, but run home to their warm beds and kill themselves.
You know, good for Bish. For reals. Like, I mean, obviously he knows. So clearly we've talked about him evolving and, I mean, I don't want to say maturing because he's not mature, but maturing in what he is actually fighting against, what he actually believes.
Sure.
But it seems like he knows what he's doing. And if he actually believes it, good for him. Because, like, it's throughout time, you get persecuted, you get killed if you go against religion or church.
Yeah. I mean, this is the first documented, I think the phrase Richard Holmes used was the first documented avowal of atheism in English history.
Wow.
So on that end, go Bish. The problem is, when faced with a decision about how to handle something he's done, Bish is very, very good at making the stupid choice. So he gets pulled into a conference with all the heads of Oxford, and they're all sitting around, and the heads of Oxford don't care that much, honestly, because they've read the pamphlet, and actually the logic in it is pretty good. The argument's pretty good, and they're not going to punish somebody for good scholarship, I think is the way he puts it in the book. So really, they just want Bish to say, yeah, I wrote it. Sorry, take a hand slap. He might get sent home for a term, but no big deal. It's over. It's done, right? Bish goes in.
Oh, no. Okay. Can I guess?
Yes.
Can I guess what he does? Okay. So he's in, first of all, he's in an enormous room. You know that scene in Harry Potter when they're like, have you seen the Harry Potter movies?
A long time ago, yeah.
Okay, never mind then. Well, listeners, if you've seen the part where he gets tried for underage wizardry, it's like this big room with like these stairs that go up and the one person down at the bottom. I imagine it like that, very dramatic.
I think you're probably right. Like they described it as being a big open room with a couple of desks in it and he's facing all of them.
And everybody looking down, amphitheater style. Mm-hmm. So he's just going to get a slap on the wrist.
Right.
Give me one little clue. Is it, does the stupid thing he does, is it right then and there, or is it in reaction to this?
It's right then and there.
Oh God. I don't know. Like the finger?
No, it's a little more subtle than that, and it has worse consequences than that.
Wow. Let me have it.
Sure. So as much as the college doesn't super care about this pamphlet, they are also more than happy to get rid of Shelley because he's a pain in the ass.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they ask him, did you and Hogg write the paper? And he says no. He refuses to admit to it, which gives the college grounds for expulsion because of basically contempt of court for refusing to answer the questions put to him. They must have been thrilled.
I'm actually surprised this is the first time. It took him till college to get kicked out of somewhere.
Yeah.
I feel like the fact that no one kicked him out of when he was setting fires and exploding things and electrifying his headmaster with a doorknob, like the fact that that didn't get him kicked out. Wild.
Yeah.
That's wild.
The college posts an authorized letter on letterhead saying that Hogg and Bish were publicly expelled. And what they do is they dress up in their most bizarre clothes and walk back and forth through the quadrangle, through the quad, looking like dejected, but also proud, walking back and forth and back and forth. Well, where's Bish now? Bish has just been expelled from Oxford. He's young. He's alone. He is trying to figure out what he wants to do with the rest of his life.
He's lost all access to gunpowder.
He has lost all access to
gunpowder. What's he going to do with the rest of his life?
He's going to stick his ungloved hand up.
No. No.
Well, my outline for Bish, I mean, the amount of tea on Bish is so great that we're going to have to stop this episode here and pick it up again next week.
I think so. Yeah. He's a fucking nutzoid, man.
Yeah.
I was not expecting this.
Any big takeaways? Any good, like, one-liners from this that you want to leave us with?
Hide your gunpowder is really, like, you know?
Hide your gunpowder.
Hide your gunpowder. And also, burn your journals. You know?
Aren't you so glad we grew up before the age of, like, Instagram and Facebook?
Oh, jeez. Jeez, jeez. Like, you know, like all the letters and the journals and the old teenage poetry and murder stories. Get rid of it, you know, like put it in a box. Don't take it then to your adult house. And burn it. Burn it. Burn it.
It's funny that you say that because Mary Shelley, either on purpose or not on purpose, lost all of her correspondence from when she was a kid.
Yep.
Maybe that was smart, Mary.
Yeah.
Maybe that was smart.
Because kids are stupid.
Well, thank you for checking out our second episode. If you want to support us, we're a new podcast. The biggest thing you can do for us right now is tell your friends. Leave us a good review. Certainly subscribe. You can also check out our bibliography, which is at bookshop.org/shop/antiquetea. That's where you can check out all of the sources that we've used for this podcast and buy one. And we'll get a little bit of money from that, which will help keep us going because I am buying a shit ton of books.
And we have a special promotion that if you tell a friend and they subscribe to our podcast, we will send you an ounce of gunpowder. So it's pretty exciting. Can you even buy gunpowder?
I assume so.
Huh.
Like Walmart? I don't know.
Ugh, yeah.
Well, on that note, thank you to
Walmart,
our producer. Thank you to Walmart. Thank you to me for editing and producing this. And thank you to both my husband and my very favorite friend-in-law, your husband.
Yeah.
And we'll be back next week.
Absolutely.
Cheers.